You're listening to The Resilient Researcher, hosted by Dalen Culver and Megan Douglas, co-founders of BDO. The Resilient Researcher is a podcast dedicated to the well-being of social science researchers who routinely find themselves navigating complex settings and sensitive subject matter. We want to bring you authentic conversations with peers and thought leaders, sharing practical insights around the mental health challenges of fieldwork. Together, we are finding our way towards a more ethical, sustainable, and resilient research practice.
Hello, everyone. Today, we're super excited to have Shivanka Gautam with us. Shivanka completed her MSc in Global Mental Health and Society at the University of Edinburgh just recently. Congratulations. And she was researching experiences of ecological grief and the politics of mourning beyond the human. She is interested and passionate about the climate change mental health nexus, as well as biodiversity conservation, climate resilience, and justice. Dale and I met Shivanka during a BDO workshop, I think, that was hosted by the University of Edinburgh. Is that right?
Yeah.
And I think that one was on eco grief and climate anxiety, I think. Yeah, amazing. And we heard about your research and just automatically thought, ooh, we have to have her on, The Resilient Researcher. So very, very happy to have you. It's been a while coming. Welcome, Shivanka.
Thank you so much for having me.
Of course. So we always like to kick things off by sharing a cup of coffee or tea, something that makes you feel comfortable. I know we're all in the UK. Shivanka, I think you and I are both in Edinburgh. Dalen, of course, you're in London. We're probably all dealing with the gloomy autumn weather. So hopefully you have something that brings you comfort. I have red wine in my BDO mug, keeping it classy. just felt like some red wine tonight. So that's what I'm sipping. Shivanka, what do you have?
I'm literally the most boring person when it comes to beverages. So I've just got some hot water in a mug because it's freezing outside, but it's a really cute mug. It says His Lordship on it. It came with the flat, and my flatmate's got her ladyship one. So, yeah.
That's adorable. I love that.
Fun that you guys found the Her Ladyship one.
It's really funny. A friend of mine was actually like, I think you should have the His Lordship one just based off of the vibes. And Laura, my flatmate, she took her ladyship one.
Oh, super cute. Love that. Amazing. Dalen, what are you drinking?
I'm kind of lame as well. And I actually don't have my BDO mug because it's in the wash right now, which is so lame. And I commend you for drinking wine out of your BDO mug because they are like supersized mugs. When me and Megan we decided to get BDO mugs to have on the podcast for exactly this purpose, to kind of start the episode with having a creature comfort drink. So yeah, you must have like 3/4 of a bottle of wine in that.
Yes, the whole bottle fit in this one gigantic mug. They are huge, which is kind of great.
It's great. I love it. I want to get more big mugs. For sure. I went over to a family friend's house the other day and she had a mug that was literally the size of a paint can. Like, I'm not even like, it must have been like 2 liter. Like, it was huge. And she's a very eccentric person, so I think she just kind of thought that it was fun. But I was like, that's so impractical. You can't have that sitting on your desk. It takes up too much room.
A mug the size of a paint. I'm just picturing like a 20-gallon paint can.
Slightly smaller paint can, like a 2-liter one.
Even still, that's massive.
Anyways, no, I'm not drinking out of my BDO mug, sadly, but I am having just water with a bit of magnesium powder in it because magnesium is good for regulating your sleep. So that's what I'm having.
Nice. Magnesium powder.
Yeah, I get it from a health food store in LA that I really like.
Your beverages are always so inspiring, Dalen.
It's a bit extra, I think.
I'll have to get some magnesium powder and yeah. Try that out. Amazing. All right, let's get into it. So, Shivanka, we're going to hear about your research that you did as part of your MSc, your master's project at the University of Edinburgh. But just to start things off, I would love it if you could explain in really simple terms what you mean by ecological grief.
Yeah, so ecological grief or eco-grief is basically just the grief that's felt in response to ecological loss or changes to local landscapes. And this can look different from different people. Some, you know, we're living in the sixth mass extinction, so there's the loss of species that comes under ecological grief, you know, deforested land, degrading ecosystems, the loss caused by natural disaster, extreme weather events, just even changing weather patterns, bleached coral reefs, a plethora of things. So just the grief that's felt in relation to experienced or anticipated ecological loss, and also the associated loss to cultural habits and changes to livelihood as a result of all of these extreme weather events and natural disasters and things caused by the climate crisis.
Okay, gotcha. So are there other emotions that you explore that get wrapped up in ecological loss? Because I'm just thinking, when I contemplate all that has been lost in terms of these really unique places and species, and it, you know, I can feel a sense of loss and a sense of grief, but then that quickly follows with a sense of responsibility, a sense of guilt, a sense of, like, all of these other emotions kind of arise from that. Are you isolating that kind of sense of loss and looking at that specifically? Or I imagine that your research has to kind of take into account all of these other, sometimes contradictory emotions that arise simultaneously.
Yeah, so I was looking specifically at experiences of ecological grief, but grief is obviously not experienced in isolation. There are so many other emotions and feelings that are wrapped up in all of this, especially in relation to the climate crisis, which is just the magnitude of it is so difficult to comprehend. And through my research, I think one of the most common emotions that came along with ecological grief was anger over the injustice that kind of underpins all of this loss. So there was a lot of anger and, like, political rage that accompanied this grief, but there's also so much helplessness in just watching these losses unfold and observing loss after loss without actually feeling any power to do anything about it. There's a lot of hopelessness in just seeing these losses unfold. I think also not having a, like you mentioned, guilt, I think not having a political context to contextualize this loss in can lead to a lot of guilt as well. And people were brought up, a lot of the guilt that they experienced, specifically with their own carbon footprint, and for a lot of them with the historical emissions and stuff that have been created through the Industrial Revolution, everything in the past, you know, dozens of years. So yeah, it's ecological grief is wrapped up within so many of these other emotions and anxieties that come along with the climate crisis and everything that's happening alongside that. So
can you tell me a little bit more? You've kind of hinted at it already when you talk about the lack of political context, and some of the other points you mentioned, but how does ecological grief differ from regular grief, say the grief associated with losing a loved one?
I think it's there in the name itself. Just calling it ecological grief kind of separates it from the grief that's experienced in relation or in response to human loss. A lot of the literature that I looked at for this dissertation looked at ecological grief as a form of disenfranchised grief because it's not really validated in the public sphere. It's not seen as something that is as heavy or overwhelming as the grief in relation to human loss. And yeah, that leads to it kind of being very invalidated, and that kind of separates it from the grief felt in response to human loss. And a lot of participants actually brought up when I asked them what grief means to them, and rather what ecological grief means to them, and whether that term actually resonates with them, they all just said ecological grief is grief. The only difference is people's response to it, because that grief is just as heavy and just as expansive, and it gets into everything the same way that grief in response to human loss does. So it's more the experience of ecological grief doesn't differ from normal, quote unquote, grief as much as the response to it does, if that makes sense.
I think for me growing up, I don't know, I don't think I had a sense that I could grieve about ecological change. I mean, you talked about like the need for validating it, and we'll come back to this when we talk about the validation of mourning over climate change. But I felt like there wasn't really an acceptable outlet or place to go. I mean, in society, at least, you know, in my context growing up in Canada, there were so many places and spaces for grieving, for things that were non-ecological. If somebody died, for example, or a marriage ended, there was a period of grief and there were rituals around that. But as a landscapes around where I lived changed dramatically in a very, you know, just in my lifespan, I don't know that what I was feeling was validated. I didn't know what rituals to engage in to grieve those things. Dalen?
Yeah, I was just thinking about my own experiences of grief, and I think they are ecological or otherwise. Experiences of grief for me have been kind of somewhat defined by proximity to whatever's been lost. So like if there's a specific lake in my hometown that I used to go to growing up, that's this beautiful alpine lake surrounded by mountains and beautiful hillsides that kind of lead up to these snow-capped peaks, and the water is just crystal clear, and it's so beautiful. It used to be the like place that I held in my mind when I meditated as like a place of peace and serenity, and it was totally destroyed in a wildfire a few years ago. I mean, the lake is still there, but all of the hillsides are just charred and all of the trees are gone, totally blackened. The water is no longer crystal clear because it's just full of debris and ash and everything else. And so having been in close proximity to that as a child and, you know, having that closer relationship, it feels more tangible, that sense of loss. Whereas when I think about the loss of ecosystems around the world, that is so intangible and so big and so hard for one person's brain to wrap their head around. And similarly, with when you grieve a lost loved one, like if it's someone that you see every day, say you go through a breakup and you were cohabitating with this person, and then all of a sudden they move out and they're not there, and your day to day is so disrupted because you're constantly being reminded of this person who was so present before and now all of a sudden is not, that grieving process feels so much more acute than losing someone who you haven't seen in years and finding out that they've passed away. And of course you still feel a sense of loss, but it almost doesn't have anywhere to land. And I think that's what you're talking about when you mention this disenfranchised grief, is we don't know where it lands. We don't know where to place it or how to actually go through the motions, the embodied processes involved in grieving.
Yeah. Shivanka, I'd love to know, I mean, Dalen and I have both shared something about, you know, our own experiences with ecological grief and navigating that, but I'd love to hear a little bit about your own kind of positionality and if you've had any personal encounters yourself with ecological grief that might have inspired this research.
Yeah, I grew up, like Dalen was talking about proximity, I grew up on a little hill station on the Western Ghats of India where my family, we have a farm and we grow coffee and pepper. And growing up on that land, I developed a very close connection with that land, and it's something I see kind of as an extension of myself. Yeah, I think I've been fortunate enough that, you know, most of my grief in relation to this, to my home, has been predominantly anticipatory, and I can talk about that and elaborate on anticipatory mourning. But there have been farms nearby, neighboring towns and stuff that have been completely lost to landslides and floods and things. And I think as I started to learn more about climate change and what we were kind of more vulnerable to, I became hyper aware of the losses that surrounded me and what future losses might look like. there's specifically one image that comes to mind, also of a lake nearby that very slowly dried up when I was growing up, and it's full now thanks to the heavy monsoons, but I felt incredibly sad watching that happen. And this happened over the course of a few years, and I think at one point it was completely dried up. You could see the cracks at the bottom. And yeah, and I didn't know it at the time, but I was grieving it. And that experience of ecological grief alongside, you know, just becoming more aware of the environmental landscape in a political sense, just knowing that the government has destroyed thousands of green spaces and water bodies and forests under the guise of development, has also been a very... very, very heavy experience of grief, and that is coupled with a lot of helplessness and not being really feeling like you're able to really do much about it. And yeah, I think for me, the interest that kind of inspired my research in ecological grief was also, I've had dogs my whole life, and grieving them has, I think, really solidified my like interest in grief in general. And I think pets are, one of my participants brought this up as well, but pets are very interesting when you think about them in relation to grief, because they're almost like this kind of segue between the human and non-human world. And yeah, I think that experience was kind of foundational and like cementing my interest in grief. And yeah, also I think what persuaded me to look into this topic specifically was looking closely and actually feeling grief for the animals in the meat industry, which, you know, their lives are not really seen as grievable in any case. And looking at that capacity to grieve beyond the human, like looking at what that can tell us about our relationship to the natural world and how we've come into this mess almost. So yeah, just the personal experience of grieving all of these losses that are seen as trivial and unmournable, and then having them invalidated as a consequence, maybe want to research and look a bit more closely at ecological grief and how we've become this disconnected from our natural environments.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the pet thing really resonates with me, as my dog is here laying behind me, and he's getting up there in age. And one of my other friends who has a dog the same age just lost him to pancreatic cancer that just came out of nowhere. And it's like the one sure thing that you know when you get a pet is that there is a very large chance that you are going to outlive them. And so you know you're going to have to deal with that someday, but we're so good at just kind of pushing it out of sight, out of mind. It strikes me this, how important this kind of proximity is for experiencing grief in a more embodied way. And it makes me think about who it is that experiences the greatest day-to-day impacts around the world of climate change. We know that it's primarily indigenous folks, countries in the global south, countries that don't actually bear the brunt of the responsibility for the changing climate. And what processes of grief they must be going through. But I wonder if you can tell us a little bit more about a subject that you briefly touched on, which is anticipatory grief. Because for me, thinking about proximity again, I can feel a real sense of loss when I think about what science predicts will happen to our planet over the next, 10, 20, 30, 40, 50 to 100 years. And I, you know, you can look at photos and read reports of what's already happening. You can consume all of this multi-sensory information to try and really drive that point home to yourself. But until, I think there is something different about seeing it in a place that matters to you and a context that really hits home. So what can you tell us about anticipatory grief and what it means in the context of climate change and in the context of eco-grief and helping us all go through that grieving process?
Yeah, so anticipatory grief is the grief caused in response to anticipated losses in the future. So a few examples of this would include like species on the edge of extinction or losses caused by wildfires and flood that are going to happen, but have not happened just yet. Coastal areas that are soon going to be engulfed by the sea, land that's set to be destroyed for farming. So just grieving future losses is what anticipatory grief refers to. But yeah, I think like you mentioned, the experience of ecological grief is predominantly anticipatory in the global north and the west, and there isn't enough research on ecological grief yet to know just how much more present and retrospective the grief is in the global south, where people are disproportionately experiencing these horrifying impacts of climate change. But yeah, anticipatory grief within the context of climate change, it's quite complicated in terms of its spatial and temporal complexities. We've spoken a bit about, you know, proximity, but with my results, it was quite clear that people were mourning the past, present, and future, in the sense that they were mourning forwards, backwards, and sideways as well, irrespective of proximity. So although the people had, what triggered experiences of ecological grief was changes to local landscapes and local environments that people had close proximity with and had a relationship with. But they were also mourning losses halfway across the world. So yeah, I need to preface this with the fact that all my participants were based in the UK and had been born and brought up in a Western country. But in terms of the spatial and temporal complexities that I mentioned, in terms of the spatial aspect, people were grieving losses and negative changes to local landscapes, but losses across the world as well. So wildfires in the Amazon, bleached corals in the Great Barrier Reef, things like that. But also the loss of migratory birds in their backyard. And then the temporal aspect, people were grieving losses that have already occurred and that losses to come, irrespective of how close they were to home for them. So it's really interesting when we talk about proximity as well. There's this researcher who argues that the alienation in the West has enabled people to build connections that transcend these spatial and temporal boundaries, which really cause this anticipatory grief and cause it to be as expansive as it really is.
Can you say a little more about that? What do you mean build connections?
I think it's something about forming these relationships that are not built off of personal and physical tangible engagement with them. So he talks about building these almost, I don't know if intangible is the right word, but building connections across space and time with animals and environments that we have not seen with our own eyes, and have not physically experienced, but still when we hear about a loss in those environments, there's still that feeling of grief and that experience of mourning it, despite having not actually experienced it.
On the topic of mourning, in your research, you talk about the importance of having space to do that. So just wondering if you could tell us a little bit more about what your research found about how people conceptualize mourning, how it might manifest, and what sort of spaces they practice that in.
Yeah, so I think I spoke about this briefly, but in terms of how they conceptualize mourning, when I asked people about the term ecological grief and what it means to them and whether it resonated, they all said that ecological grief is grief. It's expansive, it gets into everything, and it's never ending, and it's a condition, it's a permanent condition almost, of that, like, stains the past, present, and the future. It's something that you can never fully put to rest, and it's difficult to pinpoint one loss and then focus on coping with that. There's this hyper-awareness that there's something somewhere being lost to human activity, and that's something that's quite difficult to shake off. And like we spoke about, the way grief manifests, it isn't experienced in isolation. It's entangled within so many other emotions. The anger in response to the injustice of all of this loss and frustration towards industries that extract and exploit nature, and the complacency of politicians and people in power, and also the ignorance and the indifference of a lot of individuals in society. And this can make it a very isolating experience if people don't, you know, recognize or understand how heavy this grief can be. In relation to that, all participants, I think, but one, said that they avoid these conversations with close family and friends. They said that they avoid bringing this conversation, this topic, into a space that needs to be light and fun. And one participant mentioned that although they do share a lot of heavy emotions with close friends, there's something about the climate crisis that makes it a bit much to bring up. And yeah, despite this, in relation to your question about where people engage with this, people had actively sought out communities that were involved in the environmental sector in some capacity that offered climate cafes or things like that, or were just aware of the crisis and able to hold space for them. And yeah, I think with the importance of holding space, it's more about emotional solidarity than actually providing some consolation about the things are going to get better and stuff. It's more about just being heard and being able to just exist within that space and have your feelings and your experiences be validated and acknowledged as being as heavy and overwhelming as they really are, and not kind of trivialized. Yeah, it's really interesting. There was one participant who pointed me towards a paper that someone had written about. It was a very almost like an autoethnographic paper where they spoke about how people who value the lives of other animals live in almost like a parallel world to other people, reminded every day of the fact that, you know, they care for the existence of beings that other people seem to ignore or unsee or unhear. And this was written, I think, it was inspired by a very distressing moment that this academic had in the meat aisle of a grocery store, where they just kind of were overcome by this like paralyzing, I want to say fear, but I don't think it was fear, just this debilitating awareness of the injustice of all of this that they were seeing. So yeah, I'm not sure if that answered the question.
No, that was perfect. What you mentioned about your participants indicating their reluctance to share this with friends and family, I'm sure will resonate with a lot of our listeners. And it resonates with me as well. And I think it ties in with some of what we talk about in our eco-anxiety workshops, which from a compassion kind of standpoint, this desire to fix things. And sometimes when you bring those heavy feelings into a space that, as some of your participants said, feel like they have no end, there is this sense of permanence to this state of ecological grief that differentiates it from, I think, regular grief, where you hope that there's some kind of light at the end of the tunnel, that after a certain amount of time, you will cease to so acutely mourn this person or this place or whatever it is. But with ecological grief, there's kind of no end in sight. And so it can just feel so heavy, like you're burdening someone with it. And I just, from my own experience, I feel like a lot of that stems from our need to fix whatever we identify as being wrong. It's like, oh, you're feeling this way. Oh, but there's nothing I can do about it. And so it makes me really uncomfortable. And like, I'm going to just like go over here instead. We tend to distance ourselves from the things that we can't fix. And sometimes all you need is that acknowledgement that like, whoa, yeah, this is super intense and it can be really heavy and I'm there with you. And what can I do to help in this moment? Because there is no way to fix it, right? And I'm interested in the article that you mentioned about people who care about animals living in a parallel universe. As someone who was vegetarian for a time and now is not, and I grew up on my grandparents' ranch in Colorado that was a cattle ranch, and I am always like sensitive to some of my vegans friends' critiques that if you eat meat, you don't care about animals, right? Which I don't think is what you were implying, but I have gotten that kind of comment from friends in the past. Because I think sometimes there's actually a certain level of denial of the reality that death is part of life. And of course, when we're talking about eating meat, there's a huge difference between eating meat that you grow on your farm and consuming meat that's been processed industrially, and we know the kinds of conditions that it's processed under. So I think you have to differentiate there. But I think this is really interesting what you're talking about in your research, the alienating effects of othering certain types of nature, whether it's certain animals, or I think we could even extend the kind of argument to plants, othering these different types of nature as non-mournable. So I wonder if you can explain that a little bit more and maybe tether it to these wider commentaries about systems of colonialism and capitalism that have enabled it and continue to perpetuate it.
Yeah, there's this one quote by, I think, Aldo Leopold that I'm thinking of here. He says something, I have it memorized somewhere. I think he says something like, one of the penalties of an ecological education is that one lives alone in a world of wounds. And I think it's a very poignant quote here, but it speaks to how alienating it can be for people who care and love beyond this human, non-human binary, and the kind of exhaustion involved in advocating for people to acknowledge the inherent value of the natural world and non-human animals. And in relation to how this is rooted in wider systems of capitalism and colonialism, there's a researcher called Val Plumwood who talks about dualisms that have been put in place by colonialism, specifically like nature, culture, human, non-human, civilized, uncivilized, mind, body, science, soul, man, woman, even. She speaks to how colonialism used its exploits to fund the Industrial Revolution, which kickstarted the climate crisis, which, with, you know, historic carbon emissions, this has created the foundation for capitalism, right? And the human, non-human, nature-culture divide was foundational in allowing capitalism to come up being as extractive as it is. So to be able to commodify nature into a resource that can be exploited to this extent, and making nature into this dead and inert, mute thing over which humans have established dominance over, has allowed us to see it in purely economic terms. And Amitav Ghosh has this book called The Nutmeg's Curse, which I highly recommend because he fleshes this argument out very, very well. And I'm not doing his argument justice, but he speaks about basically against this this idea that it's easier to imagine the end of the world than it is to imagine the end of capitalism. And he speaks of how the normal functioning of capitalism was suspended for years during the two world wars. But what hasn't been suspended since the 16th century is the dynamics of the Western Empire. And I think he talks about how even during the world wars, the imperial powers, even though they fought each other in the West, they still maintained their they still maintained being allies in the colonies to ensure that European dominance would remain once the world wars are over. So he says what's actually harder to imagine than the end of the world is the end of the geopolitical dominance of the West, and that in this context, the architects of the Western Empire weren't just colonialists, they were also philosophers in that sense, and they solidified this way of being and thinking that cemented this division between human and non-human and nature and culture, and even between ethnic groups as well. So colonialism then becomes instrumental in establishing this dominance over the natural world and extracting its resources. So yeah, just extracting natural resources that people relied on at such a massive scale allowed the Industrial Revolution to flourish, and that divide is kind of what's created and has sustained this crisis today. In the absence of global recognition of the inherent value of nature and non-human animals, people who mourn beyond these boundaries, tend to do so in silence. And I think there's a researcher who speaks about how this experience makes people who grieve beyond these boundaries emotional outlaws. And that kind of ties it back to the alienating effects of seeing nature as other than human.
Yeah, I was just struck. I agree with everything you're saying, and The Nutmeg's Curse is such a fabulous book. We're reading it for one of my classes in the Masters of Anthropology of Food that I'm doing right now. And it reminds me of another fabulous book by Sidney Mintz called Sweetness and Power. It's kind of a seminal text in anthropology of food. And he did his field work all throughout the mid 20th century in Puerto Rico in the sugarcane plantations, and looks at the way that the growth and industrialization of these plantations, even pre-industrial revolution, like he really makes the argument that these big plantations that existed, that were birthed in the New World by colonialism, were the Industrial Revolution. And they actually powered the later Industrial Revolution that took place in the Global North. And that history does not pay enough attention to the kind of foundations laid during that time. But he also talks about this kind of binary and the way that it's allowed us to chop, to develop these GMOs and chop genetic codes this and that way in plants in a way that we would never deem appropriate in humans, which I think is a really interesting argument. And it just reminds me that I think we're better at identifying with animals than we are with plants. But I think plants are also non-human life. I'm getting a little in the weeds here, so just bear with me. But it just kind of reminds me that I think we have a hard time dealing with the fact that other beings will have to die in order for us to live. And whether it's an animal or a plant, I think we like really struggle with death. And I wonder how much of the grieving process could be eased if we were all just a little bit better at opening up a space in which those feelings were welcome, and that was a part of life, and that we could acknowledge, like, okay, this is where we're at, and how can we move forward? Anyways, that was just kind of a very off the cuff reflection.
No, that's why we're here. It's for these windy conversations. They're always the more interesting ones anyway. We never really do anything straightforward on this podcast or exactly according to plan. Thank you for all of that. It's, you know, it's such a heavy topic. It's very comforting for me to talk about these things with people like you. I mean, we've talked about having community to be able to, yeah, to talk out these hard things. And Jivanka, just to sort of kind of wrap things up, in your research or just in your own personal experience of ecological grief, have you explored any strategies for resilience among wrestling with these really heavy, hard things around a changing planet and these big lumbering systems of Western imperialism and our being complicit in systems? What sort of strategies for well-being amidst all that heaviness have you found?
I think in my research specifically, I didn't look into this as much as I would have liked to, because it was just beyond the scope of my dissertation. But one thing that came up when we were discussing how people cope with ecological grief in general was, I think the two big things that came up was love and community. And I think in response to the hopelessness that sometimes accompanies grief, or like in the absence of the hope, there was a very strong presence of love. In this specific situation, most of my participants, if not all of them, really questioned whether they had any hope. But what, and they were all engaged with the environmental sector, the climate space in some capacity. And I was very curious to see what kind of kept them going in the absence of hope, because active hope is something that's talked about a lot in these spaces. And I think what brought them the strength to keep acting in these spaces was love for nature and the natural world and non-human animals and everything in between. And there's just this deep appreciation and awe for nature. And I think that that's something that's kept people resilient in this space, because it's very often to kind of fall into that feeling of doom. And actually persevere. But love was, I think, the one big thing that came up. And also, like you mentioned, community, just having people to be able to hold space for you and those emotions and have them validated instead of kind of acted upon almost. That was something that came up. In my personal experience of ecological grief, I think something similar, just surrounding myself with people I love who make me feel seen and heard and can hold this space for me, and also just reminding myself that there's so much to enjoy still. I know with grief it's kind of this retrospective thing that all is lost and all will be lost, but reminding myself that there's so much to enjoy still. I'm very fortunate that I'm surrounded by green space here in Edinburgh, and I'm also surrounded by green space at home, and just being able to really be present in that and take that in and appreciate it as something that's is something that's kind of helped me cultivate a sense of resilience. But yeah, those are the big things that came up in my research, and I think my own personal strategies for cultivating resilience. I haven't thought about this too much. I should, but off the top of my head, yeah.
No, those sound like some good strategies and not so different from my own. I know that when I'm feeling overwhelmed and in mourning, grief has this kind of nostalgic quality about it. Like, maybe it's not a wanting to go back to the way that things were, but it's like a longing for the way that things were. And that really takes you out of the present. And I find that when I'm bogged down in this sense of what has been lost, or forward anticipatory grief, what will be lost, it is so helpful for me in the moment to bring myself back into the present, to go for a hike, to go to the beach, to watch the sunset, to see the birds flying over the water and, you know, how they skim their wings on the water, and just be reminded that, like, there are still beautiful places on this earth, and there is still beauty in the wreckage. And I think what's really brought me around to a sense of active hope is, and this is maybe a bit controversial, but this idea that, like, the earth will be okay. Like, the earth has lived much longer than any of us and will continue to live beyond any of us in some way, shape, or form. I think reframing the climate crisis as our fight for survival is actually perhaps more accurate in some ways, like whether or not we as a species and so many of the amazing species that we live here with will be able to survive, I think is actually the question. But that has really helped me not feel like so much is on the line. And then when you're not bogged down in that, you can actually, it frees up so much mental and emotional space for you to figure out, okay, what can I do? What can I do right now? What kind of contribution can I make? What is within my control? Megan, have you found, what have your strategies been?
Yeah, I think going back to Shivanki, you were talking about the importance of community. And I think for me, that's always been a big thing. I'm very fortunate that where I come from in Canada, I've got a good community of people who love the beautiful surroundings and are committed to fighting the changes, and it's always encouraging to look for the good stories, the good news, because there is plenty of it. There's plenty of people that are making meaningful changes, and you know, people like yourself, Shivanka, it's always encouraging to find young researchers and scholars who are committed to researching these tricky subjects and how all of us are just trying to navigate it. So yeah, community and looking for the good news.
Well, thank you so much, Ivanka. Where can our listeners go to get in touch with you or to learn more about your research? And we'll be sure to share all of the resources that you've mentioned in the show notes for this episode. We'll go ahead and link those.
Yeah, I don't use LinkedIn as much as I should, but if I do get a message, I will definitely respond. If you just Google my name and LinkedIn, you should be able to find me and get in touch, and I'd be happy to connect with anyone who would like to talk more about this topic and other things beyond it as well.
Perfect. Well, thank you so much. So good to connect about these topics, and I think it's very needed to have conversations, no matter how tough they are. And I do always feel lighter afterwards. It's not leaving me with a heavy kind of burden to bear. I actually am very affirmed in knowing that both of you guys are also invested in these issues and that there are safe spaces to work on this stuff together.
That could also be the magnesium, Dalen.
It could be the magnesium.
I'm feeling really good too. Is that the wine or that's just this great conversation? My paint gallon.
Yeah, a little bit of both.
No, this was lovely. Thank you so much, Ivanka.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks for listening to this episode of The Resilient Researcher. If you enjoyed this episode, consider sharing it with a friend or a colleague to keep the conversation going. You can also write us a review and/or subscribe to stay on top of new episodes. And finally, we'd love to hear from you. If there's a topic you'd like to explore, or if you or someone you know would like to come on as a guest, drop us an email at hello@gowithbdo.com. Thanks for listening, guys. Talk to you soon.